Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, this is going
to
be a fun one.
Hey, it's a good way to start off the week, man. We got a studio full, we got paparazzi, we got entourage here. This is going to be a lot of fun. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, CEO and co-founder with BIP Capital, Mr. Mark Buffington. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Mark, before we get too far into things, tell us a little bit about BIP Capital. How are you serving folks?
Well, I mentioned in the as we were getting to know one another, we started BIP Capital about 14 years ago. I was passing the hat just trying to fund venture deals then, and over the last 14 years, we've become the most active venture capitalist in the region. So we have two types of customers we serve, both investors, so we have to drive returns for them, but we also serve the entrepreneurs that we invest in.
Now, are you investing in entrepreneurs only here in Atlanta or around the country or the world?
Yeah, it started in Atlanta, and now we're really active in places where other venture capitalists, really from the coast, Boston and the Bay Area, are not active. So we do deals all over the Midwest and in the Southeast as well.
Now, was that on purpose or was that accidental?
Yeah, it was really on purpose. I spent 10 years in the Bay Area back at the turn of the millennium and kind of learned the game, if you will, and but was originally from Atlanta and started looking at what was happening in cities like Atlanta for venture activity and noticed a tremendous opportunity. So picked up the family, moved here, and it's been a great run ever since.
Now, how does Atlanta compare to the other areas when it comes to entrepreneurs and venture and startups in general?
Yeah, compared to the Bay Area, for example, it's
like kind of the granddaddy.
They're
right?
The granddaddy for sure.
So then they have a model that works for them there,
right?
And there's a lot of density of deals and opportunity. So that's kind of a unique situation.
Yep.
And then you have the other coast where there's a lot of financial opportunity, and so they have an ecosystem,
right?
And then we've kind of created our own way, the Atlanta way, right?
We have. And so when I started here maybe 14 years ago or so, there was really us and then maybe a handful of other investors in town. Today, I could name at least 10 venture funds off the top of my head, and I think there's probably 20 here. So it's a very active community. I think by any count, now Atlanta is either the third to the fifth best venture market in terms of activity in the country. So it's really active market. It's matured a lot since we've been here. And so that's great for the community. It's not always great for investors as you get more competition. So
sure.
We've looked outside Atlanta to cities like Indianapolis, Minneapolis, Columbus, Ohio, Nashville, et cetera.
So now when you look and you're looking at a prospective market, what are kind of the characteristics of a good market?
Yeah, we're looking for three things. I mean, first, in today's world, they have to be able to produce technological talent. So we have Georgia Tech here. We have, you may not think about CDC as a producer of scientific or engineering talent, but it produces great healthcare talent. So we look for the ingredients, the real domain expertise, if you will. We look for operating talent. So Atlanta has plenty of that and a lot of sophistication in marketing, finance, account management or customer success. And then we look for, you know, what we call entrepreneurial spirit. Does the city have an appetite for taking the type of risk that we're looking for? And you put those ingredients together and mix it with capital, and generally good things happen.
So now so part of that equation is to have a good public-private relationship with the government and the business community?
Not really.
Not a must-have?
It's not a must-have, no. I mean, there are certain states that have invested heavily in sparking startup activity. Mm-hmm. Georgia's not one of those. I think Georgia's done some really smart things with, for example, funding the ATDC, which is the incubator at Georgia Tech. But by and large, like Tennessee was very aggressive in this over a decade ago, but different political whims kind of come and go. And so they defunded that through time. And then you saw that their venture activity got cut in half. So it's not really clear that, or at least for us, we're not looking for government intervention because that comes and goes. But the basics that I mentioned before, operating talent, technological talent, and kind of spirit, entrepreneurial spirit, if those are existent, they tend to stay put. And those are good things to invest in.
Now, what about kind of an investment by enterprise that kind of creates sometimes a cluster around it? Like when you have a big, like here in Alpharetta, there was big healthcare IT companies that come right in there, And then because of that, you have a lot of executives that maybe come and go, and then they build around that as kind of the host.
Yeah. No, so Atlanta's really good at that. So what, you know, there's, when you first started asking the question, I thought you were asking about corporate VC, but we don't, you know, that, to my knowledge in Atlanta, that has not really spurned a lot of
economic. Right. I'm just seeing it as if a big company comes in and a lot of their, you know, they have an impact. So they bring a lot of executives, some of which kind of leave, and then they still are in that industry, and then they're building things, and then all of a sudden now you have a client that's this big company that can kind of get you at least going a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So that executive talent with domain expertise and large leverageable networks are excellent for us. A great example of that is McKesson had a large healthcare operation here in Alpharetta, I think. I don't know how many of those ex-executives we employ, but it's a lot today.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they'll have their own startup, you know, using them as either a client or kind of the catalyst to find clients.
Yeah, or they'll join a startup.
Right.
It's, you know, a lot of times executives and their mindset are not necessarily the founders of companies, but they're excellent additions very early on to combine kind of a somewhat irrational entrepreneurial experience with a rational business mind. Those things
you need both sides of the brain.
You need both sides of the brain.
So, so that's a criteria you look for if you see somebody like that, an executive that has joined kind of a startup that gives you kind of more confidence?
For sure. It's part of our formula. And we, right up front with entrepreneurs, we'll ask them, I mean, we kind of size them up and say, is this somebody who can take the company through the various stages to get to a large company? It turns out that I mentioned, by the way, we love pseudo-irrational entrepreneurs.
Right. Who, well, you need that
you
spark, right?
You got to have them. Who looks at the world and says, you know, not many people look at the world and say, gosh, that's really messed up, and I'm going to go detour my career and fix that.
Right. And invest all my time and money.
All my time and money.
To give fix up, this dream.
Absolutely. Right. And give up the opportunity I have elsewhere to do that. So those people are generally irrational somewhat. Mm-hmm. It turns out that their level of irrationality, the same skills that are needed to start businesses are not necessarily the same skills that are needed to manage 100 people. That person has to be highly rational, so we try to combine them, and we're really upfront with entrepreneurs about that. We will ask them right up front, do you want to be rich or do you want to be king? And so we get a... by and large, for the most part, it's once you walk them through the logic, they say, yeah, help me build the right team. And so
is 100 people, is that the marker where that entrepreneur probably is not doing what they kind of were born to do at that point?
No, mm-hmm. I think it's about 20, actually.
Really?
So, yeah, and even in my own personal scenario, I mean, I'm really more of an entrepreneur, built a business, realized that when I hit about 20 employees, I had HR problems. So it's just that's like a universal.
So now you're like kind of going into more of a manager role, and you're more of kind of a creator role.
And I partner myself with somebody who is much more of a day-to-day manager. So and that formula's worked very well. So I can speak about the experience personally with entrepreneurs, and I think they understand that and appreciate the fact that I've been through what they've been through.
Now, BIP Capital releases an annual kind of state of the startup report.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did that idea start?
I think that was my idea.
There you go. So, see, you're a creator.
Yeah, actually, I got to give credit. So we were, I hate marketing. I'm not a very good marketer. And my sales shtick, if you will, has always been, you know, I offer something solid and good, and if you don't want it, fine, no problem.
Right.
And that's been my sales shtick has been that I don't have one.
Right.
And it worked for a time, but I partnered myself with a COO who came in and said, we really need to start branding this thing. Give me some rope and let's build the brand out. So we started that 5 years ago. And then part of that thinking as we were interviewing other people, they said, gosh, you know, you guys are a wealth of information. You should share more of that intel. And so we started thinking, well, what would people want to know that we're in terms of the type of information we have? And so we started this study. The first was 3 years ago, first Data Startups Report. And we just started essentially indexing activity in the region by state. So there's 9 states that we track. Then we started tracking number of deals, valuations, other things that are relevant to the community. And it's since morphed into essentially an index of how mature various or how competitive various venture markets are. And so you asked the question earlier about Atlanta and how it's matured and what it's like in the community. And Atlanta has really matured over the last decade. And a lot of that is because a lot of people are pulling on the same end of the rope, trying to build, a mini Silicon Valley here, if you will, but with our own flavor. So
now, are startups in your mind, are they only tech startups, or how are you defining startups?
Well, we're focused on tech startups, but no, I think, I mean, in many ways, I'm running a financial business that was a startup. It started out of my living room.
Right. So, but yeah. That would be indexed as well?
That's not indexed in our report. We're really looking at, and so some of the data sources we use might pick up a little bit of that if it's, for example, a tech-enabled service. But most of the what we're tracking is pure technology and tech-oriented startups.
So no manufacturing, or unless there's kind of a tech kind of component?
Yeah, the latter. Unless there's a tech component, we're not tracking it in our reports.
Mm-hmm. And then the markets that you're in, are they kind of where you are in right now?
Yeah, so we're, I think you mean end markets. We're focused on healthcare. We're focused on things that the various regions where we operate do well. So, for example, in Atlanta, that's healthcare IT, media and sports tech, enterprise software as a service. I always forget some of these.
Fintech.
Fintech, for sure. Software tools. So a lot of people don't realize that Atlanta is really building a name for itself in quality testing of software. So we have three
marketing
or four.
And then
sales tech and marketing automation. Yep. So we're focused in those six areas.
Mm-hmm. That's here in Atlanta, or that's across the board?
Across the board, because the way I mentioned earlier that we are really focused on bringing people to the team that have deep domain expertise and large leverageable networks. And it turns out that you can find those types of people for our team that then have these networks that they go find opportunity, or they're aware of problems in a given end market that need to be solved. And so it gives us a little bit of a head start when we're looking for things.
How important was David Cumming building Tech Village?
I think it was important. I mean, the first incubator, if you will, was ATDC, and it's by far the granddaddy of incubators.
I mean, across the country, not just here in Atlanta, they were early in that.
Yeah, I think what David did for the city was show that there was this kind of underlying entrepreneurial spirit that was somewhat hidden. And, you know, I think I mentioned earlier, I knew when I came here over a decade ago that if I just covered ATDC and kept relations with certain angels that were active in the community, that I was seeing probably 60 to 70% of the deal flow in town. What David proved was that, no, there were a lot of people who wanted to start businesses that may not be on the radar and that you may never find. And so he launched that, and he showed how much pent-up the demand there was for really entrepreneurship and launching businesses, but then all the things that come with it, the capital and the support and the acceleration beyond that, which is what we do. So it was important. And then, so I don't know if you know this, but I think in Atlanta now, I can count 12 incubators, but there's probably 15 to 20. I don't know how many there are, but, and David led the charge in that. So,
well, led the charge of an individual kind of going out and risking their own capital to try to build something like that. Are you seeing that in other markets? Are there entrepreneurs who have had successful exits like in other markets that say, you know what, I'm going to follow that lead and kind of build a tech village in other markets?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short answer is no, because David was a pioneer in that. But then WeWork came along, which, despite their bad news later, I mean, if you go into any town, Nashville, Columbus, Ohio, there's five to however many WeWork facilities. So David was somewhat unique. And then I think, I don't want to say the window closed, because at the end of the day, they're providing specialized space for entrepreneurs, not necessarily investing capital in them. I think David does a little bit of that.
Right.
But he brings them together into a community and a place to share best practices and a place to share ideas. And so, but I think he was quite unique in that. And then I think a lot of people had the idea to do the equivalent of the Atlanta Tech Village on steroids, which was WeWork.
Right, but WeWork doesn't have the education and the kind of collaboration opportunity. I mean, they're a place where people can have an office and hang out together, but there's very specialized knowledge inside of Atlanta Tech Village.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they're doing a lot of stuff for the community to educate. I think ATDC does that as well.
Right.
I think different incubators approach it differently. We have a couple that are in WeWork. We have a couple that are in ATV. Right. And we have a couple that are in ATDC. And I would say, just in kind of descending order, ATDC does the most for education of executives and entrepreneurs. And I think ATV, and then to your point, WeWork is a little bit more laissez-faire and they're more renting office space. But there is community there as well, and there's a lot of sharing taking place. So now,
if you were giving advice to a community to build a healthy ecosystem, what would you say to spend most of their time doing?
Gosh, you know, I mean, this question has been tried. Like Tennessee, for example, launched this thing they called Launch Tennessee, and the state would kind of co-invest with established venture funds. And it did a tremendous amount of good in the short term over the first decade. And so Tennessee was, for that period of time that they were funding this, way outpunched its weight class in that, in terms of the number of deals they were doing. But it went away. And so I'm not sure that's a long-term solution, but it certainly sparked a lot of interest. I think at the end of the day, though, what you really need to get a vibrant kind of innovation ecosystem going is a number of wins. And so if you look at Indianapolis, I'll use Indianapolis as an example. They had Exact Target, which bought David Cummings' company, and now an entire industry around sales automation and MarTech has spun up. And then ancillary spaces as well, or ancillary businesses as well, have spun up there, all as a result of that one big exit that took place there. So I think those are the types of things that really spark.
But are those exits kind of just serendipity, like it just happened? I mean, is there anything you can do as a community to increase the chances of having a winner?
Well, I don't know, but if somebody does know, they can have a job at BIP Capital.
I mean, all you're doing is looking at this type of data, and you're not – so it is – some of it is just luck in that all the stars aligned. They got the right team. They got the right product. They got the right service, and they were able to
– And the harder you work, the luckier you get. There's a little bit of that too, right, Mark?
For sure. So, yeah, I would say that with anything, and even in my own career, luck has had a hand in some of the success, but no doubt about it. But there's other things that matter as we study these things. Size of market. How big is the problem? We talk a lot about something we call compulsory demand. Probably a great example of that is Facebook. I don't know how many of you guys have a Facebook account, but, it's great for connecting with your network and seeing your friends and all of that. But I'd be surprised if all of you, if you had a Facebook account, said that the privacy issues don't bother you. But the compulsory demand to see your friends and to see what's going on in their lives is so powerful that we kind of tolerate the privacy stuff. So we're looking for things like that, and entrepreneurs who find that market that where there's such a pain point that the demand for their service or their pain reliever, if you will, is compulsory. We like those kind of things. And so I'd say it's a combination of a lot of things. It's a combination of getting the right market, the right size of market, bringing the right talent around the business, timing to some degree. But as you pointed out, effort and timing and strategy affects the outcome there. And then I'd say a little bit of luck. But that said, we're scouring the earth for these things using technology all the time to say, where do those ingredients for likely success exist?
Now, what about from the entrepreneur side? What can an entrepreneur do to kind of get on your radar?
So, well, we, 10 years ago or so, we kind of sourced deals in the old fashioned way. We would meet with lawyers, we'd sit on panels, we'd go to conferences, we'd press palms, but it was very much a traditional networking approach to just showing up and meeting people, pressing palms, et cetera. Today we're using technology to really scour the earth and, all the markets where we want to operate. And so now people can call us directly for sure, and they do a lot, but I'd be upset with our staff if we're not finding a fair amount of stuff proactively. And so I guess the big shift in the market, and it's the interplay of technology with what we're doing, is that we are much more proactive today in finding them than we are reactive. But that's, that said, I'd say 30-ish to 40% of the deal flow that comes into our shop is still we're reacting. Somebody's just showed up and we had not found them.
So now what are they doing that catches your eye?
Yeah, usually. So we have on our website, and we have 12 questions that we ask generally about the problem that they're solving. So if it's a problem that is aligned with something we're interested in solving, that certainly narrows the field. And if there are certain elements about the business, like they've got traction, quick traction, they have referenceable customers, they say something about the problem that, like for example, we're really focused on the behavioral health challenge right now. We have been for the better part of 3 years. We were looking all over the country for something that was meaningful in terms of solving the behavioral health challenges that society has. Couldn't find anything. And then finally, through a conference, we met somebody who was doing something really unique. So didn't have a lot of business traction, but the tool and the way they approached it was so compelling to us that we made an investment.
Now, what about, you mentioned conferences. Here we have Venture Atlanta.
That's next week.
And that's important for the community. What about getting involved in those and having startups pitch in those kind of events or apply to be in those kind of events? How important is that?
Yes, I think it's super important. I mean, I think there's a great line that Woody Allen has. It's like 50% of success is showing up. And
50?
That's what he said.
Probably 80.
Yeah, right? I mean, just show up. And so I think it's really important to be at all the community events, whether that's a learning event at ATDC or ATV, whether that's other kind of community gatherings. But the granddaddy, at least in Atlanta, is Venture Atlanta. And so I would, if there's an entrepreneur out there listening that wants to get access to venture capital or other opportunities to grow their business, absolutely, they got to be present at Venture Atlanta.
So now for venture capital firms that are in other markets, why should I know you don't want them all to come here, but it's good for the community. The more here, the better, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to a certain, for you, to a certain level.
Yeah, I mean, so
you don't want too many.
This is a really interesting question. Have you seen the movie Beautiful Mind and kind of this Nash equilibrium on collusion versus competition? As it turns out, you know, more people coming here and building more opportunities at different stages actually enhances us and enhances our swings of the bat or quality swings of the bat at opportunities. But we did not think that 10 years ago. We thought, gosh, you know, let's keep this little pond our own secret.
Best kept secret.
Yeah, but that's not what we think today. Like, we want as much activity as we could possibly see. Now, the flip side of that is we study the Bay Area a lot, and I would call that hyper-competitive markets, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily good for investors, but we're a long way from that in Atlanta. I think in Atlanta we could do with 10 more funds, and you know, all the participants would run healthy funds and do well and drive good returns for their investors. But
so what? What would be your sales pitch to some funds that are out there that aren't here right now?
Well, gosh, now I'm going to pitch to my competition to come here.
Well, you said the more the merrier.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a very collaborative environment. There's a very sophisticated a group of technologists, but it's more than a group. There's Georgia Tech is putting out tons of technologists. So is the University of Georgia. So is Emory. So I just angered a bunch of my tech friends. But there's just a lot of technological talent here, and there's a tremendous amount of operating talent. And the community over the last 10 years has really embraced. It used to be a real estate town, but I think it's very much a startup town now. And most people know that. All the big funds are here. They're here actively. They don't necessarily say, usually what happens is rather than, and it would be hard for us to put a satellite office in a different city, because the magic of venture happens around our table as we're discussing a deal and we're poking at it. And we have one naysayer and one that's pounding the table to do it. And so good things happen when you get good ardent debate on a deal. And so what we see from the external world, let's say Bay Area investors, is they're usually establishing relationships with firms like us or another firm in town. And then they're sharing deal flow back
and then
forth.
They're kind of easing their way into the market.
Yeah, but they do it from afar. It's they do it through partnership as opposed to launching a satellite office and having an office here in Peachtree. It's hard to be kind of in a satellite office if you're not in connection with the team and constantly learning and taking advantage of all that magic that happens when you bump into people in the hallway and all that. And I think they get that. And so I think the way the industry really works is more through a network of partnerships of funds. And that's not to say that a few funds haven't moved here. They have. I think they're doing it for the same reasons I mentioned earlier, opportunity. Money is really funny. It finds a way to
So is that how you're expanding into those markets? Are you partnering with funds in those markets that you described, or are you putting boots on the ground there?
No, we're not putting boots on the ground. So we do, but it's more like assault missions, if you will. So we go in and spend we'll do like a week, 2 or 3 days with all the legal professionals, all the accounting professionals that focused in the startup world. Everybody, all the angels that are around, if there's an event in that given market, there's tons of conferences. We make sure, just like Venture Atlanta, we make sure that our people show up for those events. And we try to make a splash and let people know that we're active in the community. And then we use a lot of technology, so we're constantly building this database within different communities, and we'll send out specific mails around, let's say, what's happening in Columbus or what we like in Columbus, and that tends to
But you're learning about it through the partners that you've met when you make that splash?
Correct, or either that or their own advertising, and so we've gotten fairly sophisticated at this large marketing database that we run to kind of expand our presence or go deeper within a given market.
And then you mentioned Venture Atlanta. You'll be there?
Yeah, we'll be there. We're a sponsor of the Cocktail Hour, actually. Right. It's 10 years in a row we've sponsored the Cocktail Hour.
And then if somebody wanted to get a hold of you or get a hold of that report, what's the best way to do that?
Oh, well, the best way to get a hold of the report is just to go to our website, and there's a link at the top that says State of Startups, and so they can click through to that, and they just enter their name and their address and their email address. We get some cloaked email addresses on there, which we'd appreciate if if we get the actual email address, because we send some ancillary reports or deeper detail around that throughout the year. So that's the best way to get the report. And as far as getting a hold of us, they can find our contact information at www.bipcapital.com or just call us directly. It's pretty easy to find our phone numbers, and we try to be really open and easy to approach.
Well, thanks so much for coming in to visit with us, man.
Thanks
for
having me.
Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, keep us posted from time to time. Yeah,
will do.
All right. Hey, stay with us. We're going to visit with a couple more guests.
Yeah, that'd be great. Absolutely.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us Senior Director of Engineering Operations with T-Mobile, Mr. Calvin Gray. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Hey, what'd you learn in that last segment, man?
Venture capital is kind of weird.
Not weirder than cell service?
Yeah, really.
It's just different. It's just different.
So tell us about your work with T-Mobile.
So I've been with T-Mobile for 23 years, actually, this month. So that's
congratulations.
Before it was T-Mobile.
Before it was T-Mobile, right. Yeah. So I started
my
journey.
How many iterations ago was that?
So I started my journey here at PowerTel, and really I built the Atlanta network for PowerTel before T-Mobile even started. So that's kind of a unique situation. I've been in wireless since 1984, though. Wow. I literally got out of tech school, and I started building cell phones in a factory in Lynchburg, which is now Sony. It's a Sony factory. So I have been doing this for a long time, and I've seen a lot of change. So
what attracted you to this technology?
You know, I think just the technology itself, the way that it grows and continues to change. But I've always been a tech nut, so it just kind of drug me along as it changed.
So now, right now we're at the cusp of a big change with 5G.
Yeah.
How is that going to impact us?
So I think one of the things when I look at 5G, I think back to the history of wireless. So if you think back to the 80s, the phone was basically a phone. People didn't know that they wanted the internet on a phone.
Right.
You get into the 90s and, oh, wow, I don't need a pager now. I can actually text somebody with my phone. You know, and it wasn't really until mid-2000, you know, at 2005, 2007, all of a sudden the internet comes in, the evolution of the smartphone with Apple and Samsung, really, you were kind of pushing that envelope. All of a sudden, life becomes very different.
Right. There was a mental shift that took place, right? Where then your phone is now your computer.
Yeah.
And then once that happened, now it's my television. It's everything now.
Yeah. And it really, I mean, I think one of the unique things about the technology is that it basically brought everyone around the world closer together.
Right.
Right. I mean, you can now video anywhere in the world and show it to anyone in the world at the exact moment that you're doing it. And it's really the change of that I think 5G, when I think about 5G, I'm trying to figure out where do we go? Because, you know, 20 years ago, I didn't think we would be here.
Well, there was a time, I mean, young people don't know that you used to have to pay for long distance.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you'd have to pay per minute, and you would have to only call certain times of the day to make it affordable.
Right. Yeah. We used to just have to stop on the side of the road and put a quarter in it.
Right. To make it. Yeah. So a world where you can reach anybody with video talking, you know, whenever you feel like it, 24/7, anywhere in the world, you know, that's how young people grow up now.
Yeah.
So you're saying what could be next for them?
Yeah, I think I think, you know, the big change really is this generation is the digital generation, right?
Right.
They don't know anything different than their cell phones, their social media accounts, their privacy isn't the same as our privacy
right.
was. So I think what really changes the sky's the limit with 5G because there's so many opportunities.
But so this is going to be kind of a – this isn't an incremental change, 5G. This is going to be a noticeable change to a layperson?
I think it'll be a transformational change.
Transformational.
You really start to get to a point where you have what they call edge computing. So it lowers power on the handsets. You have the ability to have these Internet of Things sensors in every scenario. Your clothes can tell you what's going on in your body. Your wearables can interface with street lights mm-hmm. and traffic lights and traffic signals. The autonomous vehicle, connection points all become almost real time, instantaneous. Virtual reality, augmented reality, all of those things can really happen with 5G because of that real-time ability. There's no lag. So when you – like, for instance, if you're doing virtual reality, the lag today will make you kind of a little bit queasy because it just doesn't feel right. But in 5G, it's so real-time that – you could have a construction manager in Atlanta working on a project in Beijing, and he could put on the video glasses and literally be on site, real time, speaking with the person there, going through the entire construction process, going through the drawings, going through an inspection of what happened in real time,
as if he was there.
And I think that really is one of the big changes, is that ability to do the real-time analysis. I think, you know, you ever go to the UN and watch one of their sessions, everybody has a translator.
Right.
Well, in 5G, it's so real-time that the translation would be real-time. Wow. So your headset could actually translate everything for you real-time. Those are transformational changes.
So now where are we at? You know, we've been talking about 5G for a minute or two. How close to reality is it? Is it coming to Atlanta? Like, are people here using it today?
Yeah. So right now in Atlanta, we have a core downtown.
So you've that, used that it?
I have. Yeah. And it works. It works. It's new.
Well,
right?
On T-Mobile, I mean, it works. Yeah. Let's be clear.
Yeah, it's not the go to the stadium for Verizon and find one spot in the stadium that you can actually use it.
Everybody stand here in this corner. It's like the smoking section.
We built a core 5G network in downtown. It really is. It's for testing because it's brand new. But our customers have the ability to get on it right now. There's one handset out there. We launched it in June, I think, of this year. And it's unique because it's 38 gigahertz. So it's millimeter wave. Millimeter wave is very, unique. And that's, you know, a lot of the companies had kind of put their hats on millimeter wave as being the end all be all for 5G. And that's really not our strategy. I mean, we see the spectrum strategy for 5G looks like a wedding cake. The top tier is 38 gigahertz and it's very unique. It's very special. It's good for stadiums. It's good for mass gatherings of outdoor people, Centennial Olympic Park, things like that. It doesn't cover, doesn't go through walls very well. So the signal dies. So that's why people are like, all of the test results are, I have it, then I don't have it. I have it, and then I don't have it. It's because it's just, it's very unique in its frequency components. Then we looked at kind of the middle layer is mid-band. And there's a CBRS auction that's out there. And that mid-band layer is really about capacity, right? So that's where you gain your excess speeds and really can do some transformational things with it. And then we have a 600 megahertz license, which is what we're going to launch sometime in 2020. That's kind of the low and broad coverage.
And that goes through walls or that?
That goes through walls. So that low band coverage is really, really good. We're putting that in our network right now. And, you know, our plan is to launch that in 2020. You know, I think the challenge is really handsets. I mean, you've got to get handsets available. And a lot of times the network is ahead of the handsets.
And then, so you think by next year in 2020, there'll be more handsets available?
Yeah, I think second quarter, third quarter of next year, you'll start to see handsets. I think probably fourth quarter, you'll start to see some real introduction of handsets.
So we're still a full year away from kind of seeing this?
I think you're a full year away from seeing large quantities. I think you're going to have some really explicit tech people that go, I want to see it. I want to play with it. I want to touch it and feel it. You're going to have the average person go, I don't know what's different.
Right. So at that lower tier, is it going to be different for me? Like, am I going to be able to download a movie faster? Like, is it going to be noticeable, or is that incremental at that level?
I mean, 5G is download a movie in a few seconds. It is the ability to stream video
even
real time.
At that lower level, it'll be that fast.
Yeah, because it's really the bandwidth. It's not the frequency goes the distance. The bandwidth of the frequency and the technology actually provides the speed.
Okay, so all this, I wish we could take credit for strategically organizing these episodes, but all this really impacts Mark's world, right?
Yeah. I was just listening intently.
Right, because now you've got entrepreneurs that are trying to look around the corner and way down the road on this.
Yeah, they will take advantage of that in different ways. And so I was really intently listening to what you were saying, and it's educational.
Yeah, the IoT side of this is kind of the really unique and I think the real change component. Those sensors have the ability to have battery lives that are decades long. Wow. Right. Wow. So if you think about, driving down the highway and you see the little reflector strips, well, what if every one of those reflector strips was an IoT sensor and it could actually tell your car exactly what's going on and how fast the cars are ahead of you and if there's an accident a mile ahead and change direction and get in a different lane, all of those things that happen so real time. I have a BMW, and BMWs actually talk to each other. And so
what do they say?
I noticed it because the car in front of me slammed on the brakes, and it was a new BMW. Right. It told my car to slam on the brakes. I didn't even touch the brakes. So those things are really, really, the benefit of that communications network that happens when 5G becomes that real time.
And then is it going to be where it's kind of agnostic? So like if I have a Mercedes, can it talk to your BMW, or is it kind of a closed system of just BMWs at this point?
You know, I think, over time it will become more agnostic, but everybody wants their own thing and everybody will make their own tweaks. But yeah. I think a lot of this comes down to the cities and the states and the government as opposed to what regulations do you put in place? What do you want it to do? And how do you want it to impact the community?
Mark, you have a question?
Yeah, I did. So, how will 5G impact, is this just an urban thing or will it impact rural communities in terms of access and bandwidth?
No, our push right now is for rural America. Yeah. I mean, when you think about rural America, I think that will be one of the biggest transformational, areas because today, 25-30% of rural America has almost no broadband.
Right. It's a challenge we run into all the
time. They have the worst unemployment. They have all of these challenges. They don't have the ability to do online schooling. They don't have the ability for the schools to give iPads out to their kids to do homework, all of those things. We're focused on pushing 5G to rural America, and that is one of the biggest drivers for T-Mobile. That's why we're doing the 600 megahertz spectrum, is because we have a slogan that's it's 5G for all. We want this technology to be class and barrier proof, right? Everybody should be able to take advantage of this, and everybody should be able to have the benefits. And I think in my mind, I look at a really unique world of this digital generation. Do they move out of the city because cities are crowded? If I could do everything I want to do in broadband in rural America is the same, and I have the same speeds, does an entire generation of people move into rural America and really change the landscape of cities and rural America and
So then it makes the small towns more attractive in some ways because you're getting all the benefit of the kind of the technology ability with kind of that quality of life of a smaller, slower pace, which a lot of people like.
Yeah, and I'm working with a small power co-op in South Georgia, and we built some sites in those areas, and they came to us because they're losing customers because businesses don't want to stay there and people don't want to stay there.
But it's hard to stay there if there's no opportunity.
Yeah.
And if it's a detriment to be there because there's no technology, then they're going to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. So the benefit really is if you can get broadband into rural America.
So you can revitalize a lot of areas that are kind of neglected.
And you bring them up to, for lack of better words, urban standards, right?
Right.
So where urban and suburban America has the access to everything, all of a sudden rural America has access to everything. You can do the doctor online. You can.
Right. So then that doctor shortage doesn't necessarily have to be a doctor shortage anymore.
Right.
So now what does it take to do 5G? Is it just attaches to current cell systems, or is this you have to build new kind of towers?
Like, so it's there's a combination. So most of it is just hardware upgrades. We go to the top of the tower, put in some new antennas, new equipment, software.
You just wave your magic wand and that appears?
You know, a couple thousand people across the city climbing towers and moving things
around. So that's
around,
all. So you don't have to build new towers or with new stuff? Like, so it doesn't require that kind of an infrastructure in order to make 5G happen?
No. I mean, we're putting 5G on our existing sites, and it's going to cover what we cover today.
Right.
We covered 97, 98% of the population today. We will, you know, over the course of the next couple of years, we will try to do the exact same thing.
And that's what it'll take. Like you said, a year from now, there'll be more devices. So a year from now, what do you think the percentage of coverage will be for 5G?
Well, our goal in 2020 is to have a nationwide footprint. So
that 98% will be covered with 5G in a year?
I'm not going to tell you 98%, but you know, I think we classify a couple hundred million pops as a nationwide footprint. So I think our goal is to try to hit that number.
Wow. So what about here in Atlanta, in the metro Atlanta area? When do you think that that'll be covered?
I would hope early 2020.
So sometime in 2020, you think metro Atlanta, if you have a device, you'll be able to kind of tap into the 5G.
Yeah.
And what about the Internet of Things devices? They'll be able to use it as well?
Yeah. They're actually out there now. I mean, our office in Bellevue has parking sensors. Like, you pull into the parking garage and each parking space has a green or a red light on it, and it tells you it when you walk and you go in how many spaces are open and how many spaces are closed and which direction to go to the open spaces. And I mean, I think those scenarios are just going to change everything. The IoT device technology is such a cool technology. I mean, imagine today the garbage collector drives the same route, picks up every garbage can, regardless of whether it's full or not. The IoT sensor could actually tell it whether it's full, so don't pick it up. So it could create.
My wife would have a problem with that. Yeah.
But if you're around the city and you're picking up the big dumpsters and things like that,
right,
you don't.
Right.
I mean, if those sensors are available, I mean, there's just so many opportunities to put sensors on things. You can track your luggage. You can track your children. You can track your dog. I mean, and it's all real time.
Right. And it's things that we can't even imagine yet, because as people kind of see this and see what it can do, it's all those crazy irrational people are going to be coming up with the next thing, right?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
And the fact that we can go to rural America and do this.
Right. That's where the opportunity, that's a game changer.
You know, all of a sudden now farmers can use small sensors in the ground and know, you know, water this side of the field, but not the other side of
right,
the field,
we're good
or fertilize here,
right. here
or don't fertilize there. There's so much of that information that can now be gained from the ability that 5G has.
Now, you guys were involved with the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Right. So then what did you guys do for that? And what is there any lasting impact, or was that kind of a one-shot thing?
So that, you know, T-Mobile took a real unique look at the Super Bowl. It's a two-year planning event, right? So you have to start thinking about,
right, you know,
what do you have to do? Because there's a, you know, there's an extra million people that show up into right. the city. And, you know, so we spent about a year doing planning. And then we went another year, you know, working with the city, just kind of laying out the plans, trying to implement everything. You know, the unique thing I think T-Mobile did was we built everything permanent. We didn't come in and try to put up a bunch of temporary sites and then take them all down when everybody
left. So you invested in Atlanta.
We invested in Atlanta, and we put in double the capacity for Atlanta. So, you know, that we have the ability to serve the customer today, and it mm-hmm. and you know that benefit is going to last for
years.
It's
the gift that keeps on giving,
yeah.
right?
And it was actually a great opportunity for us to do some unique technology enhancements too. So we tested something called C-RAN, which is going to be a big thing in 5G. It was the first C-RAN that T-Mobile had ever done, and it was all around Centennial Olympic Park. So it was a combination of small cells and macro cell sites. It provides the ability for improved uplink. So not how fast can I download something, but how fast can I push it up to the network? And that's really unique when you think about a Super Bowl, right? Because people aren't sitting, unless it's a really crappy game, people aren't sitting there watching their phones looking for something to do. They're uploading their experience. And when that upload doesn't happen, that's frustrating. So we doubled, in some places tripled, our upload speeds inside the stadium, around Centennial Olympic Park, around that entire kind of walkable area. And that was what our big push was. So everything we were testing, all of the new technologies we put out, were all based on how fast could we make the uplink, to make the experience and the ability to share your experience faster.
So when you have an event like that and you are kind of trying to do new things like that, were you able to take some of those learnings and kind of deploy it around the country now?
Yeah. So my team actually, we brought people from Miami.
Right, because that's the T-Mobile, next.
Yeah, so they're doing the next Super Bowl. We kind of created a Super Bowl manual.
Right.
And then even the year before, I sent some of my team to Minneapolis.
Right.
Just to kind of gain that learning, kind of share the learning and keep it going. And then, you know, we as a Atlanta, you know, it's a large city for T-Mobile. So we do a lot of, you know, first application testing of new technologies and things like that. So, you know, my team does a lot of that for the company.
And then for people who aren't T-Mobile folks right now, what's a sales pitch to get them to try T-Mobile?
Wow, I'm an engineer. you know, I think the biggest problem that I see in Atlanta is a perception problem. I think people still think T-Mobile is a small carrier. I think people still see T-Mobile as the old PowerTel, and it didn't really cover all of kind of rural Georgia. And that's a very different scenario. Over the past 5 years, we've put LTE in over 2,000 sites in Georgia. We cover almost 50,000 square miles of Georgia. You know, not much of that is actually city of Atlanta. You know, but I think the big piece would be, you know, give T-Mobile a try now, because it's a very different company than it was in the past.
Good stuff. And if somebody wants to learn more, what's the website?
www.t-mobile.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you, Calvin, for sharing your story.
Yeah, thanks.
This is an exciting time, huh? I'm getting excited about this. It probably has implications for our business. It definitely does for the irrational entrepreneurs that you work with. This is a good job putting this episode together, Lee.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
Well, but this is an example, Mark. This is where the value of BIP Capital is your connections and your knowledge, right? That's how you help an entrepreneur. It's not just money.
Correct. Yeah. I mean,
so knowing Calvin probably helped you right? Because if there's questions or people are touching 5G, who better to call than the people that are building the network?
Yeah, I had like 10 questions I wanted to ask him.
We'll do a special episode just for you two.
And now you have a guy, right? Everybody needs a guy. Hey, Calvin, stay with us. Both of you stay with us. We got one more gentleman we're going to visit with.
Awesome.
All right, Lee, you ready for the headliner?
Yes.
Man, he has been so patient. He's been taking copious notes. He's been nodding his head. I know he's been learning stuff, but he has some ideas to share with us as well. Please join me in welcoming to the program Senior VP of Operations with Proof of the Pudding, Mr. Ben Witte. How are you, man?
Man, I'm doing fantastic. What a morning, huh? I'm so pumped up that T-Mobile is going to 5G because finally my MySpace page is going to be flying. And I'm super pumped about that. Thanks for making that happen.
Well, tell us about Proof of the Pudding, and the technology is important to a company because you're in all these events. You're catering all these events, right?
Yeah, I was super excited when I heard the tracking thing because we're still trying to find 500 tongs from last night's party. And maybe there's a way to get that decal on those tongs. I'm envisioning this grand pit of tongs somewhere for all us caterers.
So tell us about Proof of the Pudding, your family-owned business that's been around Atlanta for quite some time.
Yeah, we're in a 41 years old this year, and we've been here in Atlanta, based in Atlanta. It started out with a young lady down on Peachtree, Kate Goldstein, making brownies and chicken salad. And the good news is we're still making that same recipes today. And then a gentleman by the name of Phil Noyes and Guy Thompson bought out Kate, and that was about 39 years ago. And that's when the magic happened, is that we were just here in Atlanta, and very similar to the other stories, is it was just awesome, maybe a couple other caterers. And then the great president, Jimmy Carter, if we could put our R&D back on the shelf for a second, started the Carter Center Library, and that was our first account. So
that's the first kind of big corporate account like that?
First big corporate account. It was our main kitchen. It was pretty much everything. That's where we started to grow the company with.
So now what kind of was enticing about doing that as opposed to just doing normal catering?
Well, we needed a kitchen. Kitchens are real important in food.
Was your kitchen before?
What was on the 10th and Piedmont location, very small. Uh-huh. So that's when we got to the bigger size.
So then that enabled you to have a more larger commercial kitchen that you could use for other things, not just the Carter Center?
Exactly. We just moved into our new building. It's over there by Topgolf. And I cannot believe for 39 years we were cooking out of the Carter Center kitchen.
Really? Oh, so this is now the next evolution is where you are now?
Next evolution. Yeah. Come on down. We'd love to have you. We got a wall of whisk.
You give tours?
Oh, we absolutely give tours, and hopefully you'll buy catering from us.
So now, what's in the new place?
Well, here's the thing that makes it so special is we have a huge kitchen. So we're making the food there. Our sales team is there. Our accounting's there. Of course, administration's there. We have this thing called a warehouse with all kinds of stuff in there for all the parties and 8 docks now. So it's a wonderful building. Built for the future, not just today. And that's just for our offsite division. That doesn't count the other accounts. So the offsite is just run out of that property.
And you're still doing you've evolved into lots of now large corporate clients.
Absolutely. We're so blessed to be in seven states right now. We're in 6 convention centers, 7 stadiums. So it's really tough sometimes when your stadium, like Auburn is playing Georgia, you don't know who to pick because we're doing the food service in both those stadiums. We just want to make sure the food's good. We're in 2 arenas.
So what does that mean you're doing the food? So like every restaurant is actually you guys?
Well, in the stadium operations, we're just doing the premium. So it's the suites, it's the suite operation and club level operations.
So, but then they'll have like restaurants will have their own setup.
Yeah, that's done by the concessionaire.
But anything that's kind of stadium centric is you.
In the premium areas only. Right. In the fancy areas.
And then, so you have a whole sales team that just goes after that kind of work?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically, the sales team for the RFPs is basically myself and Adam. Adam Noyes, the president of our company. But how we get these properties is it's all about the relationship. Uh-huh. And that's how we built the empire.
And then, so you did some work at the Super Bowl as well.
Mm, we sure did. Sorry about that. We sure did. Our favorite location was the NFL house over the 200 Peachtree. And that was for all the big-time sponsors and players, and you weren't allowed to bring your cell phone, so I just wish we could to take some pictures.
You weren't allowed?
We're not allowed because T-Mobile had something against it. No kidding. Just kidding. A little joke. you'll laugh on the way home, I promise you. And it was really cool because we had there was a great shot of Joe Montana and Steve Young sharing a beverage at a table and all the great big stars, and that was spectacular. And then we did Guy Ferrari's barbecue tailgate party the day of the Super Bowl. We did a great party called Maxim Party.
So how do you work with the chefs? Don't they have, aren't they picky about their food?
Oh, yeah, they sure are. Yeah, you know, like back to the charity thing. When we do the Zach Brown Camp Southern Ground, first year we had Emeril Gossy, and then last year we had Guy Ferrari again. And they're not picky. They're really just super guys, and they're superstars, and they're really cool guys. And chefs have their own language. They're like their own kingdom of language out there, and they're cool, and they hang out, and they're, of course, want to make great food.
So now, now as this kind of – now you're entering the second 40 years.
Yep.
What are the plans? Are you expanding? You're obviously expanding outside of Atlanta.
Yeah, we sure are. I'm entering my 27th year with Proof. And you know what's really exciting about that? I get the 2-week vacation package now. I'm
wow,
super
congratulations.
Bummed up. Yeah, thanks so much. Going all the way outside 285. But we're expanding right now. Our biggest thing is in 2 weeks. We're opening up the boat show down in Fort Lauderdale, and there's 5 of those shows. Hopefully this Wednesday we pick up 4 secret locations that we can't talk about until Thursday. That's pretty fun. But our number one thing is right now is Road Atlanta opens up this Wednesday.
And then what about like kind of regular folk catering? You still do that, like weddings and events and parties?
This past Saturday we had 9 weddings that were going on throughout the city of Atlanta, all the way up from Yona Mountain all the way down here to the Atlanta. When I was looking at what we were doing this past weekend, we had 17 events and offsite. We had a sold out football
game. Is that a good week or is that a regular week?
I think that was a good week. It could always be better, especially as an owner. It could always be better.
Right.
We got a big building to pay for.
Exactly.
Seen it.
and we had a sold out football game up in North Carolina, and we had a sold out football game down at Georgia Tech. So it's just kind of fun to see all these events happening at the same time. Of course, it all comes down to the people and the team.
So now it's still a family owned business?
It sure is. It's owned by Phil Noyes and Adam Noyes, the president and chairman of the company. The Noyes family, Phil is a genius businessman. He's been in Atlanta since 1984. We used to be at the MGR Food Services, George Will Congress Center, Georgia Dome, and Centennial Olympic Park. And at the same time, he had Proof of the Pudding, and I joined him in 92 over there at those 3 properties. And then Phil sold his shares to a company called Levy Restaurants in 2004. My non-compete was up in 7, came over to the Proof side of the family. And so there's 6 owners. There's Phil and Adam, myself, Janice Wilmer, has the best job in the world. And this is why it's the best job in the world. She gets a company card and just goes out and buys stuff. You know, and she comes back with this creative stuff. You put it on a buffet and you're like, wow, that's really cool. But I would have never picked it on a shelf. Then we have Chef Vaughn Nielsen, who's been with us 37 or 38 years. He's Danish. He's got the best voice. Ah, come on now. We got to make the cookies. That's exactly how he sounds. And then we have Bin Liu, who's our controllers. That's part of the genius of Phil, is every one of us partners as a division of the company to make sure everything's going well.
So now, are there any kind of differences of working for a family-owned business than a non-family-owned business?
That's a great question. When Levy bought us, that was a huge company. I mean, Larry Levy at the time was he owned the company. It's his name above the door, like Merritt used to always say. And then he sold the Compass for a little number called $300 million. And Compass is the largest food service company on the planet. Mm-hmm. But when Larry was there, he was a true entrepreneur, and I used to love his spirit, and you would love his entrepreneurism. He took chances, and he always wanted to make sure that the customer was right and did what he had to do. And we both love concerts. So, a quick little story. So you're trying to outdo this billionaire, right? You know, he goes, hey, what's your favorite concert, Ben? And I go, wow, it's down at Verizon. Saw Fleetwood Mac front row. It was awesome. And I go, what's yours, Mr. Levy? And he goes, well, there was one time that John and Paul were in my living room playing Let It Be. I said, John and Paul from the Beatles? Yeah, he won.
Yeah, it's hard to compete.
It's hard to compete.
So now, Proof of the Pudding is not kind of a big corporate entity, right? You still have that spirit of kind of the scrappy entrepreneur.
We are definitely. That's our whole niche is when we're going into sales. We're not like the big guys. We're going to do it your way. We're going to buy your milk. We're going to buy whatever is desired for your location.
So you're kind of a challenger brand in that respect.
No question about it.
And then so how does that kind of help you get these large accounts?
Well, I think what they do, the first thing they do is they pick up the phone and call our current customers. And they say, how is Proof of the Pudding? Because we can say anything we want to say. And we have never lost an account, knock on a table made out of wood, in 41 years. And I think that's what makes us different, is we're not doing it our way. We're doing it your way. It's about the partnership with the client, the customers, and so on and so forth.
But you get – okay, so when you're competing against these kind of mega firms that are hundreds of millions of dollars, firms that are doing, you know, the Smithsonian and doing these large corporate accounts, how do you kind of get them to just try you? Where, like, no one's getting fired hiring them.
Right. I think that our niche is, if you're looking for millions and millions of dollars a check to buy the business, as it's called, we're not that company. We just don't have that. We are the company that is going to do the business your way. And my favorite story is when we signed on Auburn 6 years ago. And we were there with the folks we were just meeting for the first time. And the person that was there, Tim Jackson, was there. And he goes, two things. He goes, aren't you the guys off 85, that white right. building that we used to be on Monroe? And also, don't you do Chastain? Because I used to love the wedding bag that you did at Chastain. Chastain represents probably 0.5% of our annual sales. Right. But it's probably our most famous thing that people go, aren't you off of 85? Well, we're no longer off 85, but we still are Chastain. That, so he remembered the bag. That's
right. So that, so it leaves a mark. Your work leaves a mark.
Absolutely.
And then that's kind of the secret sauce that gets you in to have these conversations. And once you have the conversations, then you feel pretty confident that with your book of business and your relationships, so you'll be able to sell them.
That's our goal. Yeah. We're going in for, like I was saying, for Wednesday for 4 new accounts. And hopefully that's going to go. We know. Well, let me rephrase that. It's going to go well.
Right.
Well, I have a question about recruiting and development.
Yep.
Because you've built this culture. You have so much on the line now. And you have to consistently go out and find good people to carry on the tradition. I would think that you would be most vulnerable out on site with the boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. So talk to us a little bit about how you go find these people and what you do to get them up to par in the proof of the pudding way, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Well, it took me a minute to get it out, but I thought it was a fantastic question. What do y'all think?
Yeah, great question.
It was awesome. In fact, I'm going through my notes right now how to answer that. But I think our secret is that you are working with the entrepreneurs and the owners of the company. You're not going through 5,000 layers of a corporation to get approval to buy yellow carrots versus orange carrots. If the client wants it and the customer wants it, that's what they're going to get. But the people is the hardest part. It's easy to buy food. It's easy to buy equipment. It's easy to get there. Those are all part check marks that are easy to do. But finding the right person, like all the events we talked about on Saturday, that all happened because of individual talents is making it happen. It's not Ben running around all around the city making that happen, or Adam or Vaughn. We hire the right people. And there's a great saying, there's a lot of great people that used to work at Proof of the Pudding because they didn't fit in the culture. They didn't fit into taking care of the customers. This past Saturday, where we had the events going on, and we have a group text going, and you see how passionate they are to make sure the wedding is perfect and the dinner is perfect and the reception is perfect. And when and if there is something wrong, they're going to battle for you to make sure it goes well. And that's just part of our culture for 41 years.
So how do you identify that person? How do you meet them? Everybody's on best behavior when you're first meeting them. What are some clues that you have the right fit?
I think what we're doing right now is we have an internal referral system. So we just hired, let's just call them Bob or Julie. Bob or Julie just came on board, and we have an opening that just came on board. Hey, Bob or Julie, do you happen to know anybody? And you ask within the company. So I think our first
resource, that's where you start, is within
where
the
we start.
Whenever you're looking to hire, you start within the company first.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so proud now, like 27 years ago, when if I was going to be interviewing somebody for a job, we would have one property, the Georgia Dome, Georgia Book Congress Center. And it's hard to look at the guy and girl and go, hey, in 5 years, you're going to be this, because the guy might not be dead or moving there anymore. Right. But now we have all these opportunities in all these states. So it's so much easier to convince you to come join us to work and vice versa. And of course, it comes down to economics. Can we afford you? Folks out there today, this is a buyer's market for staff. It started, we were part of an LCA organization called Leading Caterers of America. And everything starts in California. And in California, they were talking to caterers in California, talking about how dishwashers are signing $3,000 and $4,000 signing bonuses.
Signing bonus. For dishwashers.
Yeah. So they don't go to the other caterers. Hope that trend doesn't come here.
Wow.
But that's how, and then of course we go through Facebook and LinkedIn and all those accounts to put the ads out.
And then when it's not a fit, you have to exercise the discipline to, in whatever fashion is appropriate, you got to end that, right? And move on.
You got to end it and move on for both parties.
Yeah.
Yeah. For both parties. You know, the worst type of, there's nothing more stressful than terminating an employee. There's nothing more to receive it or to give it, quite frankly. But you want, when in that process, you want to make sure they know what happened and vice versa. And it just sometimes doesn't work. I was married for 25 years. I'm now divorced. It was the best marriage ever, but now we're divorced. I know this isn't Dr. Phil's show. We're not going to go into the reason why, but it sometimes just doesn't work out.
So now what do you need more of?
Oh boy. We are always on the lookout for great talent. even if we don't have a slot, we're going to put you on the bench. We're going to bring, we just talked to a guy yesterday, flew him in from, not yesterday, excuse me, Friday, from Philadelphia. We don't have the spot for him, but he's now on the bench. And when we get those new accounts, we have a starting quarterback, starting pitcher, whatever sport you're into, that you go right into it.
So if somebody wants to learn more about Proof, website, what are the coordinates?
Let's go over to proofpudding.com, and that will give you all the information.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Well, that's a wrap for another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. We will see you all next time.